think we're about ready, and we have, let's see, we have one, two.
We have a quorum?
Seven. Benson's been here, I think, right?
Yep.
How many do you have?
Benson, Hoffman, Marty, Brown, Rosen, Eaton, six.
Dibble, Rosen.
Dibble's here.
Rosen, Scalzi's here. We got a quorum.
Scalzi's here. Then we're good.
This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. We have a long agenda, and we are continuing this evening, I believe. So we're going to start with Senate File 666, Senator Eaton, the Wolf bill. And for this bill, because we have to have time limits to get things done, and I know there are more than enough people, both sides of the issue, who wish to speak on it, we are going to limit testimony from each side to about 20 minutes. Have time for the committee deliberation because we are today and tomorrow we have a long agenda. Senator Eaton, you want to bring it forward, and after you present the bill, we will then have 20 minutes for each side.
Agenda. So I have the. Oh, yes.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Senate File 666. It's a bill relating to natural resources, reinstating the five-year moratorium on wolf hunting, amending Minnesota Statutes 2012, Section 97B.645, Subdivision 9. And my whole purpose in pursuing this is that there was a discussion, there was a plan for how to keep the wolf from becoming extinct, nearly extinct again, and the agreement was a five-year plan upon which there would be a discussion as to whether there'd be hunting or whatever. That plan was circumvented, and we had a hunt after not having a count of the wolves for more than 5 years. Or nearly 5 years, let me correct myself. And now they're in the midst of a count, and we do not know how many wolves we have. And to me, it just makes common sense when you've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to bring a species back from near extinction that you would wait and see how you were doing before you started having a recreational hunt. I have Senator Hottinger here with me.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Hottinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's nice to be back, and Senator Eaton helped get me elected many years ago, and it's great to see her up here. Chair Marty and members of the committee, my name is John Hottinger, and I'm testifying today as a board member and as the immediate past chair of the Sierra Club North Star Chapter, a grassroots organization working to protect Minnesota's environment with over 30,000 members and supporters across the state. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate File 666. The Sierra Club's worked to protect the wolf for many years, in fact, over three decades. As a result, the Great Lakes wolf population has made steps towards recovery. Gray wolves once roamed the United States from coast to coast, but they've been eradicated from all of the lower 48 states except one, Minnesota. We're the only state with an original native population that has continuously existed. Gray wolves are a keystone species that allow many other plants and animals to thrive. The loss of wolves would upset the natural balance to the detriment of future generations. Wolves have brought millions of tourist dollars to rural regions of Minnesota as people come to experience these extraordinary animals. Wildlife areas are a key part of Minnesota's outdoor recreation economy and the people it employs. However, despite significant progress, the wolf still occupies just a small portion of its historic habitat. We have extremely limited data regarding the current size, health, and stability of our state's wolf population. For these reasons, Minnesota's official passed into law Wolf Management Plan included a requirement that no public hunt be implemented for at least 5 years after delisting. The five-year waiting period was a compromise, agreed to from a strong partnership of stakeholders with a widely inclusive list from hunting, agriculture, conservation, tribal, and public entities. Last year, however, the legislature passed a provision to allow hunting of wolves in violation of that plan's five-year moratorium. On your Senate website, each of you has a link to a publication, How a Bill Becomes a Law in Minnesota. It guides Minnesotans in how laws are made. You remember, introduce a bill, have hearings. The website, in fact, tells Minnesotans the bill is discussed in one or more committees. After discussion, committee members recommend action, approval or disapproval to the full Senate. But that didn't happen last year. The removal of the five-year monitoring period happened without a bill, without public notice, without testimony, without a committee hearing. For that all-important committee discussion, the provision was instead slipped into a bill that had to pass after the government shutdown. Passage of Senate File 666 to reinstate the five-year waiting period would honor the original intent of the state's management plan and allow for a scientific population assessment and the development of a responsible, data-driven plan for the future. In addition to being good policy, Senate File 666 corrects one of the more blatant abuses of our legislative process in recent memory. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Senator Huttinger, and welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, Barry Babcock was not able to make it, so he had a conflict. So I have Howard Goldman.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Howard Goldman, and I'm the Minnesota State Director for the Humane Society of the United States, and we support passage of this bill. And I want to thank Senator Eaton for her leadership on this critical issue. The Humane Society of the United States has 170,000 members and supporters in the state of Minnesota. I was a member of the Wolf Roundtable that was pulled together by the DNR in 1998. Very diverse group of stakeholders, farming interests, hunters, trappers, the tribes, environmental groups. And our mandate was to come up with a management plan for the wolf, which we did. It took us almost one full year. We had 12 separate meetings. And one of the critical pieces of this was a five-year moratorium on the public taking of wolves after wolves were delisted from the Endangered Species Act. I also represented the Humane Society of the United States at the delisting hearings that were convened by Fish and Wildlife in Grand Rapids. In fact, I offered testimony last year before this very committee in opposition to the season on wolves. As Senator Huttinger said, wolves came off the endangered species list short time ago, January of last year, and the state of Minnesota rushed to establish a hunt. The five-year moratorium that I referred to a moment ago that came about as a result of the consensus of the Wolf Roundtable was lifted. Expedited rulemaking procedures were put in place. There were no public hearings, and yet a season was established. The wolf population in Minnesota has been stable without hunting and trapping since 1998. The last statewide population survey was conducted in 2007. The DNR has stated publicly there's no biological basis for the hunt. It's not to control populations. And we don't eat wolves, of course. There's only one reason for a wolf hunt, and that's sport, trophies, recreational killing. No more, no less. Wolves that kill livestock are being trapped by the USDA and the DNR. We have no objection to that. We haven't raised any questions about that. It's necessary to do to protect farmers. We prefer to see non-lethal methods used. But when those have been exhausted and you have to take a wolf that's depredating, then we certainly understand that. Last year, 299 wolves were killed that were depredating on livestock. And that includes wolves taken by the USDA, by the DNR, predator controllers, and also by landowners and ranchers who are now authorized to take wolves that are preying on livestock since wolves have been delisted. Now, we've heard many claims about depredations by wolves as justification for the season. I just want to share one critical number with you. There are 165,000 cows and calves in wolf territory in Minnesota. There were only 81 confirmed cases of livestock depredation last year, according to the USDA. I spoke with the director of the program in Grand Rapids just last week. 81 out of 165,000. Needless to say, that's a very, very low percentage, and I would hazard to say that ranchers and farmers lose far more to disease and to other predators than they do to losses for wolves. During the hunt last year, 413 wolves were killed. Now, that's in addition to the 299 that were taken under depredation measures. Moreover, we estimate that illegal killing of wolves was as high as 250 in the state. The shoot, shovel, and shut-up practice is alive and well in Minnesota. There was one study conducted on Camp Ripley, a 10-year study. 20% of the wolves that were radio-collared were killed illegally. 5 were shot, 1 was poisoned. Now, if you add those three numbers together, the 413, the 299 taken under the depredation programs, and the 250 that we estimate were killed illegally, that's a total of 962. Very hard to be precise in this. I just want to give a benchmark figure. That's over 30% of the population were lost due to human-caused mortality. 30%, according to many biologists, is the tipping point where populations begin to decline significantly. People in Minnesota care deeply about wolves. And we're asking, simply asking in this legislation, that the 5-year moratorium be reinstated, that the roundtable recommendation be fully honored. It gives the department and the state time to fully study the population, to better understand the effects of the delisting on the population, to hold hearings across the state, to gauge public opinion. This is not just another game species. It was almost extirpated from the landscape. If we must err on the side of caution, urge the committee to pass the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. Questions? I think we'll go through the time slots for both sides and then take questions.
Okay. Nicole Hendrickson?
I believe they're about
Debbie Pierce.
13 minutes left. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
My name is Debbie Pierce.
Bruce Olson.
First, I want to thank you for the chance to speak to you today about what wolves mean to me and to our family. First, I want to say how very proud we are to be from Minnesota, as we're the only state that has maintained a continuous wolf presence. Here in Minnesota, we've had many opportunities to share our love of wolves with our girls and our grandchildren. We've visited many state parks with them to chase the chance to see or hear wolves' presence. We like to camp in Teteguch State Park and often lie awake at night hoping for the chance to hear wolves. I've awakened them in the night to hear wolves howling on more than one occasion. They are thrilled by this. Last year in Itasca State Park, we even found tracks and scat. There is nothing like lying in a tent and eavesdropping on the wolf families as they call out in the dark to remind us that we are all part of one big, beautiful family. My husband and I have been visiting Yellowstone National Park for the last 10 years for the sole purpose of wolf watching. Many people we've met there are envious of the wolves we have here in Minnesota, and I'm very proud of that. Seeing wolves in the wild is a deeply moving experience. To us, wolves are a symbol of true wildness. Over the 10 years, we've learned about the many packs in Yellowstone and their family lines. We know these wolves by name and their unique positions in their wolf families. Packs equal families. That's how it works. The alphas and the alphas are the moms and dads, like 06 and 755 of the Lamar Canyon pack. The yearlings are the babysitters. Middle gray was playful and so protective of her new sibling pups. 820, another yearling, was an independent sister and beginning to be quite a hunter alongside her mother, 06. When family members are randomly killed, chaos ensues. Packs that lose their alphas can fall apart. Pups which are born in the springtime and are only 6 to 7 months old during hunting season are too young to fend for themselves if they lose their mother or their babysitter. Their chances of survival are slim. This wolf hunt in Minnesota has been devastating to my entire family. Up until last year, we were not going to hunt wolves for recreation. I implore you to do the right thing and reinstate the 5-year moratorium that was responsibly included in the wolf management plan and unjustly tossed out. Please ensure that my grandchildren will be able to share the same wild experiences with their own children. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pierce.
Cole?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and begin.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Nicole Hendrickson. I live in Brooklyn Park. Bonjour, Nicole, and Indigenica, Jagina Shimong, Brooklyn Park, Nindinjaba. Good afternoon, senators. I appreciate the time. My statement's going to be as quick as possible. So for far too long, we as Native people have had been denied the opportunity to voice, to have a voice. And what we're saying to you today is that Mayingan, the wolf, is very sacred to us. It has a historic role and also a role in our lives today. Having access to these animals that were here pre-European contact is really important to us. We have learned to act as family units through teachings from the wolf. This was learned through observation long, long ago. Wolves have a moral right to exist. And I don't expect for you to have a clear understanding of how sacred they are to us. But I am asking that you do respect it. All Ojibwe nations here in Minnesota have declared their territories as wolf sanctuaries. This is because of their importance to us as a society. I have invited my family here. This is my son, Noah. This is my fiancé, Zach. He would like to take 1 minute of your time.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and begin.
Aho, bonjour, and dinaway magani dog. Ni nao, benesi be dagoshin. Makwa and do dem. Awa babi gana kag and dunjiba. Gipi naza kunin them, way wane. Chigagi gidot tamawag, a ao maingan. Apchi go, pitain dagozi ao maingan. I came here in front of you today to talk about Mayingan, our brother, the wolf. He's our spiritual brother. He's one of our most sacred animal beings, a guardian of our sacred ceremonies, the Madewan Lodge. Also, he walked the earth in our creation story with the original man, and they named everything. I want to talk about the importance of the wolf. He's our, like I said, our spiritual brother. Our ceremonies have a lot of respect for the wolf. And we are parallel with the wolf. It's in our teachings that whatever happens to Mayingan is going to happen to man, to Anishinaabe. We walk together like this. And this is what I was told by our elders, and I came to relay that message. And so I feel very strongly about this, that, and we as Native people are against the wolf hunt in Minnesota. And that's what I came here to tell you.
Thank you.
Miigwech.
Miigwech. Thank you.
Thank you. And sir, because we don't have your name on the record, if you could sign the list that they're putting there for you. Thank you. And Senator Eaton?
Maureen Hackett, my final witness. Dr. Hackett.
Dr. Hackett, you have about 6 minutes left. Please identify yourself and go ahead.
Good afternoon, senators. Thank you for hearing this bill today. I appreciate it. I'm Maureen Hackett, and I started the organization Howling for Wolves. I'm also a physician. I specialize in psychiatry, and I still practice. I'm a former military officer also. I became involved in the Minnesota's wolf hunting plans when I learned that we were moving very rapidly towards a wolf hunt within the same year that the wolves were basically removed from the endangered species list. In fact, the appropriations bill and the rulemaking process was planned even before the wolf was removed from the endangered species list. So Howling for Wolves formed to give people information and to give people a structure. What we found was that we had a law in place that was represented to the people for 10 years as the law. I know that there are even letters from the DNR to citizens in May of 2011 telling citizens the law is that we won't have a hunt for 5 years following delisting. That was May of 2011. July 2011, the law was removed by the legislature during the budget shutdown. Locked doors, not a lot of opportunity for public input. So what was a vetted law, what was a well-done law, was removed very quickly, just as it was about to take effect. So Howling for Wolves formed to give people a voice. Also, I do want to say that in May of 2010, the DNR petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to delist the wolf. And in that petition, the wolf management plan was referred and contained the five-year wait before hunting and trapping of the wolf for public take would be considered. That was in the plan, and that was referred to in the comments of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in their delisting. So ARVIS basically formed in order to, Howling for Wolves formed to give people a process. The DNR used an expedited emergency rulemaking process, which ignored or bypassed any public comment, but they did do an online survey, and in that online survey, 79% of the respondents opposed a wolf hunt. Now, the response to Howling for Wolves was tremendous. People were shocked. They were confused. And as they got more information, they wanted to know how they could have actions and take legitimate actions, you know, organized and productive actions. Most did not realize the wolf was even delisted, and then they did not realize we were rushing to a hunt. So we had people gather signatures, come to events, contribute monetarily, and groups from around the states came together also. You've heard some of them today, people who represent the Native American culture, the Ojibways, ecologists, animal activists, wolf and wildlife organizations such as Center for Biological Diversity, the Sierra Club, Audubon, Minnesota. All of us, along with HSUS, as you heard, worked together. And since last spring, we've gathered, just Howling for Wolves, over 10,000 unique Minnesota signatures onto a letter to Governor Dayton and to the commissioner of the DNR to not have a wolf hunt. We also gathered 32,000 or more than 32,000 out-of-state signatures and more than 3,000 international signatures. So people don't want this wolf hunt. They're willing to compromise at a five-year wait. They realized that was the law, and that was the compromise that was reached. During the actual hunting and trapping season, people expressed to us that having Howling for Wolves was helpful. They felt like they had a way to act and express their opinions. We had a December 1st rally in Virginia, Minnesota, that was organized by someone from Virginia who was missing the howling that she heard every night because once the wolf hunt started, she lost her packs. She knows that they are the packs that were in her area. We've had letters from all kinds of people talking about missing the wolves that they usually saw. And one woman in Bemidji introduced herself to me and told me she lost her dog to a trap. So what we want to do is we want to put forth this proposal, get it back in place, and I want to tell you a little bit about a poll we had conducted by Lake Research. The poll was done with 600 calls, random dial, digit dial is what you call that. That's a little more expensive because it can't be done by computer dialing. We only accepted registered voters. We had 25% of those polled were cell phones. And again, it was random digit dial, so it wasn't done with a voter file. It was weighted for statewide proportions, meaning that we had metro area, the collar suburbs, the north and the south. And what we found was that the vast majority of Minnesotans do value the wolf as an asset to protect for future generations. That was 79%. Two-thirds of the respondents thought that the wolf hunt was unnecessary if wolves could be killed if they threatened livestock and pets or people anyway. 66% oppose the use of traps, snares, and bait, and 67% opposed the decreased penalties of wolf poaching. And finally, our poll results showed that the majority of people supported the five-year wait before a wolf hunt would be started after the wolf was delisted. Now, there are many reasons to have a five-year wait. Those reasons were vetted back in 2000, but I'll just mention a few. We have an economy here that actually depends on tourism, and we could develop more of it. The Ely International Wolf Center reports that they bring in $5 to $6 million a year to that economy in Ely. The wildlife viewing industry is a $531 million a year industry. We know that the wolf is important for other wildlife, but even if it's just for the wolf, even if it was only 10% of that, that's $53 million a year. So we know that there's an economic basis. But another reason that I can speak to that the lawmakers need to understand is you heard the history of the wolf. It was persecuted and hated almost out of existence. There's a small minority still in existence here in Minnesota that would like to kill wolves, whether it's legal or not. There's been these statements that having a wolf hunt decreases or the hatred and increases the acceptance of an animal. I can tell you, as a psychiatrist who deals with a lot of violent behavior, you don't really change aggressive behavior by making that behavior more legal. Instead, you model non-aggressive behavior. So we know, and if you look in your packet, the International Wolf Center has stated this misguided mistreatment of the wolf is real. It happens. People are caught. You know, there was just a conviction last week of a man who ran over two wolves with a snowmobile plow, or not a snowmobile, a snow plow in the National Forest. I believe it was Superior National Forest. We also know that people are incidentally snaring wolves. Six were snared just in January. So the wolf was never before has an animal been taken off the endangered species list and hunted immediately. And when I asked the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service specialist on endangered species in the Midwest, she said never has happened. And you have to think about, well, why would you have such a rush to hunt wolves? We didn't have this rush when the eagle came off the list. We don't have this rush for any other animal. Why? Well, you have to look at the history of the wolf to get an understanding. And out west, where they've had hunts now since 2009, and they've eliminated 70% of their wolves, the hatred is still rampant. It has not decreased. So a really good reason for a five-year wait is for us to assess and to monitor and to actually try to mitigate that small group minority of people, but also to look at what's the value of the wolf to our state. How can we as a state come together to support livestock producers and the rest? So I urge you, we need this 5 years. We were promised it. It was represented by law. It was in law and quickly taken out, and that's not democratic. And please support the democratic process.
Thank you, Dr. Hackett. And the time for the proponents went over a couple minutes, a minute or two, and we will give the same to the other side as well. I'll ask. Well, let's take the other side first, and then we'll ask if people have questions. So, thank you very much. We beginning with Mr. Spreck. Welcome to the committee.
Hello.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Tim Spreck. I'm president of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. MOHA, many of you are familiar with, is an organization that represents approximately 400,000 sportsmen in the state of Minnesota through our 68 member groups. On important issues like this, we bring considerable influence to bear on behalf of our members. Our membership is united in support of continuing the wolf hunting and trapping season as it is. It has proven to be biologically and economically sustainable. You'll hear more information about that later from some representatives from the DNR. But MOHA is here to support continuation of the season as it is, and I'll get out of here and let some additional people testify. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Spreck. Wayne Johnson, and if you, I'll just go down the list I have on my list. Wayne Johnson, Gary Lystico, and Gerald Tyler would be the next three. Please go ahead, identify yourselves, and begin.
Good afternoon, Senators. I'm Wayne Johnson. I'm the treasurer and member of the executive board for the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I have just a short statement I'd like to read, and then I also will get out of the way. Under state endangered species laws, the wolves were listed by Minnesota as threatened in 1984. They were removed in 96 because their populations had met Minnesota's recovery criteria. They were never extirpated from Minnesota, and in fact, at their lowest population levels, it was still estimated there were 500 to 700 wolves in the state at that time. Under federal law, Minnesota wolves were delisted from the Endangered Species Act in 2007 for 20 months. It was during that time that the last survey was conducted. The DNR managed them until the federal lawsuit instigated relisting under ESA. In January 2012, they were again delisted and announced under state management. Today, Minnesota has a minimum estimated population of 303,000 wolves in 500 packs, the largest population in any of the lower 48. That 3,000 is taken at the absolute low point of their population cycle, so February and March. 2 months from now, that population level will likely double as the pups are whelped. Minnesota DNR's wolf management plan is scientifically sound. It has been approved by the Minnesota Legislature and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The wolf plan was adopted in 2001 and at that time included a 5-year wait after delisting before wolf season could be considered. However, in 2001, it was expected that the wolves would soon be delisted as their numbers were growing and well above goal levels. The 5-year wait was removed from the Minnesota Wolf Plan in 2011 due to the recovery of the wolf population and due to the original delisting in 2007. In other words, time served. Wolf research and management professionals agree that Minnesota's wolf season does not threaten nor have any detrimental effects upon Minnesota's wolf population. Biologically, at least one-third of the wolf population can be removed each year without jeopardizing the overall population. Wolves are a renewable resource. Like any resource, they need to be managed. Hunting can and should be a continuing part of the wolf management plan. Hunting also helps pay for that management. Hunters, as a group, are willing to pay for their opportunity to participate. And those dollars, in turn, provided $284,000 last year for management of the wolf. Lastly, just like with bobcat, fox, beaver, and other fur bearers, managing wolves ensures their healthy future in Minnesota. Hunters are not anti-wolf. We are pro-wolf management. We would like to see a healthy, stable population. Finally, the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association opposes passage of this bill. We support a managed wolf population in Minnesota with hunting as an intimate part of that management. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Gary Leistico. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Gary Leistico. I'm a volunteer attorney. I represent the Minnesota Trappers Association. I am a trapper myself. I'm here on the behalf of the Trappers Association. The Minnesota Trappers Association supports a long-term viable population of wolves in the state. It's very important to trappers that that continues to exist. The Minnesota Trappers Association also supports the limited hunt and trapping season that was allowed last year. That trapping has significant restrictions on the activity. There were additional restrictions placed by the law for the season last year. The Trappers Association also asked for legislation in 2008 that would require that new trappers would be certified before they could purchase a trapping license. That was also part of the Wolf Bill last year. And all new trappers that were coming in seeking licenses for wolf trapping were required to be certified. It's a volunteer program by our association. We pay for all the costs. There's no charge to those taking it or no monies from the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Tyler, and then next up we will have John Gilbertson, and then the two farm group folks. Is Mr. Tyler here?
Yes.
Oh, he's coming. I'm sorry, I didn't see you.
And you're trapped in the corner.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Go ahead. You.
Water.
Thank you. My name is Gerald Tyler. I live in Ely, Minnesota. I have asked St. Louis County Commissioner Mike Forsman to join me. In 2009, I brought an action. Actually, it was in early 2010, to delist wolves. The action was brought against the federal government in the way of the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we brought the suit because the depredation of wolves in Ely, throughout the state actually, had reached alarming levels. We had a number of wolves that were habituating actually parts of Ely, and it had reached the state where something had to be done. I called a meeting. We had the Fish and Wildlife Service, the International Wolf Center. I talked to Dr. Meech, who the foremost expert on wolf and wolves, and we finally brought the suit in early 2010. I'm a biologist. I've also hold a law degree from William Mitchell, and I would like to reiterate very briefly, very quickly, the history of the delisting of wolves, because the delisting of wolves is exactly how we got here today. In 1978, wolves were, in Minnesota, were placed on the threatened list. They've never been on the endangered list in Minnesota since 1978. Early in 2000, after the wolf management plan was adopted by the state of Minnesota, an action was brought to delist wolves. Not an action, actually. The Fish and Wildlife Service brought this whole issue to the endangered species list. And in 2007, as has been testified today, wolves were delisted. The 2007 delisting began the time period pursuant to the wolf management plan. Wolves were brought, put back on the list when HSUS, the Humane Society of America, brought an action in federal court in Washington, D.C., and wolves are again put on the list due to over the merits of the lawsuit that they were endangered or threatened, over procedural grounds. In 2008, the wolves were delisted as a result of the 2007. Again, in 2009, the Fish and Wildlife Service again published a final rule, as they have to, in another attempt to finalize the proposed rule issued in March of 2006. Again, the Humane Society of the United States and the Howl for America and some of the other groups that are here today have testified, brought an action. Again, in federal court in Washington, D.C., and again, the rule delisting wolves was reversed, was vacated. Again, on a technicality, wolves had recovered, and in both instances, the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service people conducted extensive research, and they were thus delisted. The reason that I oppose, and many of us in northern Minnesota oppose the list, the moratorium, the reinstatement of the moratorium, is because the depredations continue. I've asked Mr. Forsman, the St. Louis County Commissioner, and St. Louis County passed a resolution supporting the delisting of wolves, is because we have some problem wolves in Minnesota. Why don't you hold the picture of the photograph of the Woeful.
Mr. Tyler, Commissioner Forsman, welcome. Mr. Tyler, are you going to have Commissioner Forsman now speak, or are you just going
to? No, I'm just, I want him to hold that up. I want to talk about why we support, why we oppose the moratorium. That is a wolf, the photograph of which was taken from an automobile. You can give it to them.
In a page, cool. Thank you, Andy.
And it was taken from 12 feet from that wolf. It's very common to have wolves in Ely around the schoolyards. There's a photograph, Mr. Forsman might show up, of a wolf collared standing in front of an apartment building, home to all kinds of young people. We know that. We don't support the hunting of wolves for trophy, for sport, for anything else. But if this moratorium is imposed, I would point out to you, as someone else pointed out, there'll be no money to support the trappers that have to go out and take these depredating wolves. And you're going to have more instances of depredation because too many wolves have been habituated. I would leave you with this thought, and I know there's a discussion that will take place. If this moratorium is reinstated, as it said, even though it shouldn't be, the 5 years, 7 years has gone by since wolves were first delisted, then this legislature should take action to find the funds to take care of these depredating wolves. If not, it's only going to lead to more illegal taking of wolves, and no one wants, excuse me, to getting dry, to see that. And with that, I'll thank you. And
Mr. Tyler, thank you. Commissioner Forsman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's good to be here. I came because Jerry's a friend of mine, and he has been very active in this, and as you know, and has testified here before. But St. Louis County did pass a resolution in support of the management of wolves, and I think that's the key, is that we are asking the state of Minnesota to continue the management of wolves. Certainly, no hunting, no trapping, there is no management. And I do have one other exhibit, and this is an exhibit from a friend of mine. I would like to have, if you could pass it among yourselves, you can keep it. But it's a picture of something that happens way too often in northern Minnesota. This picture is a picture of Steve Biondich, a friend of mine, and his dog. If you notice, his dog is still on his collar, but the dog has been eaten by wolves right near his, as you'll see in the pictures, it is even close to his implement shed and close to his home. This is not unusual. We have had any number of people that have lost their animals, and most people that love dogs, love cats, they do appreciate the wolf, but they don't appreciate the wolf eating their dogs or their cats. The other thing is, I live two blocks from the edge of town, which is in Ely, Minnesota, is in the woods. I mean, let's face it. But three blocks in from the edge of town, there were four wolves spotted in someone's yard there because we have deer going through our community. So when the domestication of wolves, and that's kind of what I think it habituated is the way Jerry says it. But I think to me, a lot of it just seems like they are not afraid of people. And when you have them showing up in the alley three blocks from the edge of town in a residential area and you have kids around, et cetera. Granted, it was at night. Most of the kids were in bed. But people have pictures of them in their yards. And I'm sure that there's many people that would be willing to send them to you. So it is about the management of the wolves. This is not about trying to make anything. I heard the word hate here. I don't think it's about hating wolves. I certainly don't hate wolves, but I don't want them in my yards. I don't want my grandchildren in my yard and having the wolves right within a block of my home there. So I guess that's all I would say.
Thank you, Commissioner Forsman. Thank you, Mr. Tyler. Next up, we have John Gilbertson, and then in the batter's deck is Tom Peterson and Chris Raddick. So, Radatz. I'm just thinking about it today. Forgive me, guys. Mr. Gilbertson, welcome to the committee. For the purpose of the tape, please introduce yourself and let us know where you hail from.
I am John Gilbertson. I hail from about 20 miles northwest of Bemidji. I am a farmer. I've been a farmer, lived on a farm all my life. And I want to thank you for having the opportunity to come here and tell my story today.
Welcome.
I've lived on the farm I live on now for 44 years. I grew up about a mile from my place where I live now. I grew up as a child. Back in the days when I was young, you know, every once in a while somebody would be out in the woods cutting wood or something and say, we seen a wolf track go through the area. There's been a wolf in the area. That's quite a few years ago. As the years go on and back through the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, we started having some problems. I have continually had problems of wolf kills on my farm for several years. When it first kind of started, it seemed like it would, you know, we'd have a kill. Maybe we'd be lucky to go a couple years without, and then we'd have another one. But the last few years, it's every year. And we had dairy cattle for several years, milk cows. And I actually have had timber wolves come down in the morning to bring up some heifers. Excuse me. And I've had timber wolves come right out of the shed where a heifer had just calved. They're after the calves. They're after these young animals that are just born. We've even seen where a cow has laid down to start calving. The calf is starting to be born, and the wolves will be there eating on the calf before it's completely born. Our kids have raised sheep. Years ago, they came right up in our yard. We don't pasture our sheep out in the woods or nothing. They're right up by the buildings. Wolf come in there one night and killed three of our prime sheep. They always say they take the old and the weak. Well, we didn't really have any old and weak. These were all prime show lambs. And when a wolf kills these lambs, it's pretty devastating to these kids because the wolf ain't a kind killer. We hear people talk about how cruel it is for a wolf to put his foot in a trap. Well, when a wolf decides that he's going to kill something, he's not very kind with him either. With the sheep and the DNR were out there and actually scun them out and that, they had never a mark on their throat or anything. They literally just knocked them down. They tear the ribs out of them, and they eat the livers and the hearts, and they'll go on to the next one until they get full. In that situation, we found this mess in the morning. We locked the sheep up that night in a building, and the wolf came back. And then he did start eating on the carcasses that he had killed the night before. We've had him take calves right out of our yard. The latest, last year, we had a mule, a small mule up in the pasture where a pack had run him up into a brush pile and killed him. And our grandkids came along in the evening after school. We're driving along the edge of the field and found him. He'd been killed the night before. Just a nice mule that they had out there, but they'd run him up into a brush pile and killed him. And by the next day, the next night, the wolf was pretty much cleaned up. Not the mule. We've just seen more and more as time goes on. We've had the DNR in and trap many, many, many times over the years. A few years ago, they took 9 out 1 year. Like I say, it started kind of that. You know, it wasn't every year, but in the last years, it's more frequently. In the last few years, it's been every year. I've heard people say, in fact, somebody here said to me today, well, why don't you run alpacas with them? I've got a neighbor that run, not alpacas, llamas. I had a neighbor that run llamas with his sheep, and they had young ones with them, and the timber wolf ate the young llamas. So they're not fussy what to eat, and I truly believe that the problem comes from too many wolves. I'm not against the wolf. The wolf is a beautiful animal when he's where he belongs, but he's not that beautiful when he's in my cow yard. I see a lot of T-shirts around here today that says howling wolves on it. You know, if I'm laying in my bed in a motel down here in the cities and hear a wolf howl, that's a beautiful sound. But when I'm laying in my bed at home and my wife and I hear a wolf howl, it means we better hit the floor running because he's probably after one of our livestock in the yard. We're not against hunting. We're for the hunt. We think that it needs to continue. We need to reduce. We truly believe the numbers are much greater than they are, and if we can reduce the numbers somewhat, they'll eat what they normally would eat naturally and not eat our livestock as much as they have been in the last few years. The kids, you know, it's pretty devastating when these kids at work all year with their 4-H animals and stuff, and they come out to find that a wolf come up in your yard and killed them. So I appreciate you having let me speak today, and I hope that they will continue to let the wolf hunt go on as scheduled. I believe it's the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbertson. There, Mr. Peterson, Mr. Raddatz, if you can do it in 2 minutes, it would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I also live in Pine County on a farm in the wolf area. And our policy does support a wolf hunting and trapping season. Our policy is set by our members. They pass resolutions. I think every county north of the metro area, including Isani and Kennebec County, I see senators on this committee, pass resolutions this year supporting a wolf hunting season. The dollars raised by the wolf hunt, we believe, are important in supporting our state's professional management efforts, which include professional trappers. A couple other quick bullet points I want to make. Not every farmer can hunt and track a wolf and is skilled at it, and so those professional trappers do come in very handy. Not every farmer reports every kill and seeks reimbursement for those kills. A lot of my neighbors, they just don't they don't recognize that a cow has been killed in a timely manner, and so they don't. We heard 80 cows had been killed. It's much higher than that. Not every cow is reported. Wolf kills really impact our smaller producers. I have a farmer who lost had a herd of 27 calves born in the last year, lost 6 of those calves. Our farmers do take preventative measures, such as fencing, having donkeys or llamas, et cetera, and they do try to manage wolves themselves, but are obviously not as successful as they used to be. In closing, I just urge that we do feel the DNR has determined that the population is strong enough to support a hunt, and we urge you to oppose this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Raddatz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Chris Raddatz, Director of Public Policy for Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you. I will be very brief. I would echo Mr. Peterson's comments, and I'll mention also that Mr. Gilbertson serves on our State Board of Directors, and there's many more stories like that out there with farmers who continue to have problems with the wolf. We do support the DNR being able to manage the wolf population in Minnesota. We feel that should include the depredation-type programs, the trapping, but should also include hunting and trapping season. We feel they put together a reasonable, responsible hunting season last year, and we hope that can continue, and we do oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's it for the testimony. Both sides were good within a couple of minutes of the 20 minutes we asked for. Questions from the committee discussion. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Senator Marty. I'm wondering if there's anyone here from the DNR that can give us their position on this issue.
Mr. Meyer, I saw. Is there somebody else from DNR? Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes. While he's coming up, I'll point out that there are a number of materials in your packets from Wolf Center and a whole bunch of places. I hope members will take a look at that. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. We'll try to make this brief. I'm Ed Bogus, Director of Fish and Wildlife for the DNR. I've got with me our wolf specialist from Grand Rapids, Dan Stark, and we're rather than go through a lot of information, we're passing out just a kind of a fact sheet for the benefit of the committee that reviews kind of the history of wolf policy in Minnesota. The recovery of the population, the federal delisting you've already heard a lot about. It's been on and off over the last several years. Wolf management since populations recovered, which required not only recovery in Minnesota but recovery in the Western Great Lakes region for the Fish and Wildlife Service to delist. So Minnesota's goals, as was accurately stated, we were the only state that maintained population. Our goals were reached within the state in the late 1980s, but in the whole Western Great Lakes region, it wasn't until the late 1990s. So, and then there's information in this packet about wolf damage management. We have a program. There used to be a federal program. That program now, due to federal budget cuts, it was actually suspended in December of 2011, but the DNR has been contracting with the federal USDA Wildlife Services since April of last year to continue that program on an 8-month out of the year basis rather than the 12 months when it was a federal program. So it's the same program, but with state funding instead of federal funding. There's also state certified trappers and a wolf damage compensation program that's run by the Department of Agriculture. There's information on all of those programs in this packet. And then there's wolf season implementation information in here. And I just wanted to say quickly that DNR is committed to the long-term sustainability of wolf populations in the state and to resolving conflicts between wolves and humans. That's the goal of the state management plan, which was finalized in 2001. We do closely monitor wolves. We used to do a total population estimate on a 10-year basis. We now do it on a 5-year basis, but we do annual trend monitoring through track surveys and indices. And kind of the point of, I think, where we're at in terms of wolf policy in the state. Some of the earlier testifiers talked about wolves being persecuted. That's true. There were government programs to persecute wolves. There were federal programs to eliminate wolves in the late 1800s and early 1900s. The state of Minnesota paid bounties on wolves until the mid-1960s. So policies have changed. Times have changed. We're certainly committed to the long-term survival of wolves, but the season that we had this past fall was actually the first managed season on wolves in the state's history. Prior to 1974, when they were fully protected under the Federal Endangered Species Act, wolves were fully unprotected under Minnesota law. So the DNR had never had an opportunity to manage a season on wolves until last year. It was the most closely and intensively managed season that we've ever had on any species. We had literally daily monitoring of harvest, and we were closing areas based on daily harvest totals. We've never done that for any other species. We use a science-based approach. We obviously are going to take whatever direction we get from the legislature and manage wolves consistent with our management plan. And with that, we do have Mr. Stark here. If there are technical questions about wolves or wolf biology or some of the wolf policy, that's his area of expertise. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions from the committee for the DNR?
I have a question.
Sir Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just kind of wondering because I look at, first of all, if you have an anticipated new season on any species, I don't care if it's wolf or any kind of species that has not had a hunting season before, what is your typical method of establishing that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, typically we would look at the population. I don't know if you're asking about population or process here, but typically we look at the population of that species and what could safely be harvested and what sort of a management structure for a season we would need to keep that harvest within the safe harvest level. So for small game species, we have typically long seasons with high limits and no need to close seasons. For other species that have more limited populations and that are more vulnerable to over-harvest, we'll have a drawing for licenses. We may have a quota on the number of licenses. The wolf is, like I said earlier, the only species that we've actually set a quota on the take and then close the season once we reach that quota. So it varies by species and how vulnerable they are.
Senator Scalzi.
Actually, I was talking about the process. What I asked was, how do you go about doing that? How do you go about a typical process where you think maybe there needs to be a season and license and all that for a new species? How would you typically do that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, we would go through a public comment process and we would do a rulemaking to establish that season. That's typically how we do it. In the case of the wolf, you know, we had pretty clear direction after last legislative session that was the direction that the legislature expected us to go was with a wolf season, starting with the firearms deer season.
Mr.
Scalzi.
So then you didn't do a rulemaking when you wanted to decide to have a wolf hunt?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, we did do a rulemaking.
You did. And I just have just one more question. Because I look at the map and I see this wolf population is where I grew up. I grew up in Barrette. We always had wolves. And I grew up on a farm. We always had sheep and chickens. We didn't have kills. We did, though, have in the area that I came from a lot of wild dogs in packs. And typically what we were led to believe is that a wolf will hunt for food, but the wild dogs will hunt for sport. They do. A pack of dogs is a pretty scary thing. When you did your trapping, you were trapping for wolves, did you ever or have you ever caught dogs that were wild dogs in those traps?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, I'm going to defer to Mr. Stark to respond to that question.
Mr. Stark, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself before I respond.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dan Stark. I'm a large carnivore specialist for the DNR. Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, there have been dogs caught in traps while trapping for wolves. I think in recent years it's fairly rare when we're either doing research trapping or the depredation control trapping that's done. I don't think that there's feral dogs as common as there may have been, you know, historically, as you mentioned, as today. So that'd be a pretty rare occurrence.
Thank you.
Mr. Bogus, one follow-up to Senator Scalzi's comment. I see somebody had in the letter, maybe from DNR, the letter from former Commissioner Holston to Secretary of the Interior in 2010, which he talks about population management, including public taking, will be considered in the future, but not sooner than 5 years after federal delisting. But the line I wanted to comment on is if in the future public taking is proposed by DNR, there will be opportunity for public comment. I heard from some of the proponents of the legislation, they felt the DNR did not give public comment period at that time. Could you tell me what was the process after the legislature authorized the ability to do it?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Of course, there was a lot of hearings leading up to our getting the authority. After we got the authority, we did an online input process for taking public comments. As I said earlier, we felt we had clear direction on whether or not to have a season, and so our input was primarily about how the season should be structured, what types of seasons we should have. We had a limited amount of discretion in that because the law said the season had to open with the start of the firearms deer season. We had initially proposed a later season that was not incidental to deer hunting, that was more specific to wolves. So we did propose to have an early and a late season, early season as required by law, late season as we had initially proposed. So we took comments through an online process.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Heaton, I'm sorry, I was looking along here and it didn't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify that there hasn't been any public hearings on hunting since 1995. There was the one online, and that was mainly directed toward hunting.
Thank you. Senator Dibble, then Senator Benson.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Bogus or Mr. Stark, I'm curious about poaching. Arguments have been made that allowing the wolf hunt relieves some pressure on illegal killing of wolves. On the other hand, the counter argument is that when we passed the season, we significantly lowered the penalties for poaching. Do we have any sense on either side of that argument yet? Do we have any data? Do we have an understanding of
Mr. Chair, how
bad poaching was? Has it gotten better or worse?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, it's not been that long to have much evaluation. I know I'm talking to our enforcement division who you know, monitors for illegal taking. They are investigating a number of reports of illegal taking. I don't recall the exact number, less than a dozen. Obviously, we can't catch all of those. I know it's been postulated that allowing a season would improve tolerance and reduce illegal taking, but I'm not aware that we have any data on that.
Thanks. Follow up.
Go ahead, Senator.
I noticed in this document that you handed out as you started testifying that you're planning to do a comprehensive survey and a population count, et cetera. Does that include evaluating some of these dynamics?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, Mr. Stark may have more to add on this, but that's a survey that's been done by a standardized method for about 30 years now. We do, as I mentioned earlier, we initially did it on a 10-year interval. Now we do it on a 5-year interval to kind of corroborate trend data that we're monitoring on an annual basis. But it's just it's simply the range of the wolf, documenting the range of the wolf, pack sizes, pack numbers, and then calculating an overall population number. It doesn't get at illegal taking.
So,
Senator Dibble.
So thanks. So is there a plan to figure out which side of this argument what's actually happening around poaching? If you know, is lowering the penalties, has that had a negative effect on poaching, or allowing the wolf hunt has had a positive effect on poaching? Are we going to try to figure that out? Some form
Mr.
or fashion.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I think Mr. Stark could comment more. Probably the best data that we will get on that question is through telemetry studies, and there are a number of them that have been ongoing and still are going. So I'd ask Mr. Stark to talk about what we can learn from those telemetry studies.
Mr. Stark?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I think it's pretty difficult to get an actual number for illegal mortality. They'd have to do a comprehensive population dynamic study. I don't know what, you know, sample size you would need in order to estimate what the actual number is. It would require a very intensive radio collared study of the population. But regardless, during the time that wolves were listed as an endangered species, the level of illegal take was not enough to not allow the population to recover, and it's exceeded those population objectives and criteria for decades. Our population continues to do well and remains stable, even though those activities are going on. And there's certain things on wolf population dynamics that we don't fully understand. We don't have solid data on, and over time those things are studied, and there's been some publications that have been done in Minnesota, but it's not an ongoing thing that is done. It's a more intensive type of study that would be required.
Senator Benson and then Senator Brown, and there are lots more. I hope we can wrap it up fairly soon. I want people to get the chance to ask their questions and whatever. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Eaton, some of your testifiers indicated that this provision was done in the dark of night, behind closed doors, no public information, no public input was allowed. In fact, the budget bill that was passed through special session had been passed previously, and I looked up some information. Senate File 943, Section 53, looks like was passed in May, was vetoed by the governor, had this provision in it. But there was also a floor vote that failed on a bipartisan basis. So when people have been led to believe that this was not publicly vetted, it went through the entire legislative process. It only got signed during the special session. And so I think we need to be clear that there were lots of hearings and lots of opportunity for input. It just happened to hit statute out of a special session, but it wasn't that it wasn't publicly heard. And so that and the fact that the animals, the wolves had been delisted in 2007, gave us 5 years for the DNR to look at this. And so was in keeping with the spirit of the statute that was in place and then was removed. And so I will not be supporting you on this bill.
Senator Brown and Senator Oz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Stark, if this moratorium doesn't pass, how will the DNR manage the hunt so that the wolf doesn't end up on the endangered species list?
Mr. Stark.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, we'll continue to monitor the wolf population as we have in the past and as we're laying out now, with comprehensive surveys every 5 years and annual monitoring that's done every year looking at indices of the wolf population. We have a winter track survey. We have a carnivore scent post survey that's done. We have depredation indices. We have some of the ongoing research that's done by Dr. Meach up in Ely. All these things are corroborating evidence towards what the population is doing and supports that our population has remained stable over the period of time between those more comprehensive surveys. And each year make adjustments based on new information, whether that's through regulation or limiting the number of hunters or the number of licenses available or the number of wolves that can be taken.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Stark, it sounds to me, with everything that you've said, you put a great deal of science behind managing the wolf population. Is that accurate to say?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, that's primarily what my role is as a biologist, is to evaluate the population information that we have and make recommendations on what, you know, we think the population can support in regards to, you know, whatever management aspect it might be.
Thank you.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. On page 3 of our handout that you provided has a dot matrix of the harvest last year, which actually is quite illuminating because I would have expected the dots to be far more congested in certain areas. Can you speak to your management program for the last wolf hunt in that I think you indicated that there were zones. How many different zones did you have, and how did you alert hunters that had permits? I assume the permits were zone-specific, and how did you alert them that the zone was full and they were no longer able to continue in managing the harvest?
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmek, there were 3 zones that were established for the wolf season to distribute some of the harvest or the take of wolves in different parts of the state. Each of those areas there was a harvest target set for each of those zones, and that information was available on a website and also on a 1-800 number where hunters and trappers could call and check the status of the season. Unlike other seasons that we have for other species, we don't have information on what hunting and trapping success rates are for wolves. And so we set a number when we would close the season or initiate the closure of the season. And so it was important that people had to check those numbers and know what's going on during the season. And that's basically how it was managed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question. The numbers we've been throwing out here today on the current size of the population is something in the 3,000, 2,500, maybe 3,500 range. Do you have a current estimate this year after breeding and after the pups mature, how many new wolves are going to be added to the population prior to the next hunt or prior to the next management season?
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmek, we don't have a specific estimate of those numbers. There's no direct measure of what the pup production is each year, what all the different causes of mortality are. But we can make some general assumptions about, you know, based on the wolf population size, the average number of packs or that we estimate are out there, and the average litter size that has been observed. And it's a cycle each year in the spring when pups are born, the population can nearly double. We have, you know, maybe an estimated 500 packs based on our last population estimate. And if each of those packs has 5 to 6 pups, you know, we generally see, you know, a significant increase. But wolves die throughout the year. Pup survival is low. And so, you know, potentially there's already thousands of wolves that die each year. It's just trying to manage that number and identify what would be sustainable, including, you know, a hunting and trapping level.
Okay. Thank you.
Sandhill. Thank you. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to add that I grew up hunting. I have nothing against hunting. My concern is for the survival of the wolf. I believe that when you put these kind of resources into protecting a species, that it doesn't make any sense to automatically start a recreational hunt once they are delisted. I do believe that I feel at a disadvantage as far as data and information, since the DNR states the hunter as their main client, and that their whole purpose is to make sure that there's a good take, which is their word for kill.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, just a question to you. What's the next destination for this bill?
This bill would go to the, I believe, the Senate Finance Committee. They have, there is a fiscal note because of the loss of licenses, I think.
Mr. Chair, wouldn't that actually go through Senator Tomasoni's group? Because they
that's,
are the...
That's, he's that's the finance.
Oh, I'm sorry. I heard finance, but not the Tomasoni finance. Thank you.
Division.
Senator Benson.
No, Mr. Chair, I was going to make a motion that we move the bill.
Okay. On the motion that Senate file...
And I'll ask for a roll call vote, Mr. Chair.
666 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. The roll call has been requested. Any further discussion from the committee? On that motion, take the roll, please.
Senator Marty?
Aye.
Senator Benson?
No.
Senator Brown?
No.
Senator Dibble?
Yes.
Senator Eaton?
Yes.
Senator Herr?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Senator Coonan?
No.
Senator Osmick?
No.
Senator Rosen?
No.
Senator Scalzi?
Yes.
Senator Schmidt? Senator Sieben?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
No.
By a 7-6 vote, the motion does pass and goes on its way to the Finance Committee. Now, as people get up and leave, I will ask people to
go out
that door. We have people coming here, so please keep it fairly quiet until you're out in the hall. And Senator Dibble, your bill is a fairly quick one, I believe. We'll see.
I appreciate your understanding.
We're going to wait.
Just want to make sure we don't want to keep it going.
This is the first time.
No problem. Thank you.
It's going to be tough in the next committee.
Which one's that? Oh.
She's coming up.
Yep.
It deals with the sustainability of the the current population. What is the ideal population?
Viable.
There's a 10,000.
Yeah, they call it viable. It'll reproduce itself about the same level.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
I know, it can be debated.
But you could have 100 and still only take 30.
Well, it might not be that.
Whatever you want.
Yeah.
Good amount of wind energy. Something a little less.
Senator Dibble, Senate File 642.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. At Senate File 642, and Mr. Chair, I have an amendment.
In it covers the thing.
File 642, there's an amendment, Senator.
Just to
Mr.
everybody
four around, or?
It's the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Is it in the packets?
I don't think so.
We may have you start presenting the bill, and we'll have
all
the
right.
Amendment, Mr. Fuller.
I have a copy here if someone needs to.
What do I need?
Just copy in my office. Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. What Senate File 642 seeks to accomplish is to allow for the capture of waste heat from industrial processes and other forms. And use that waste heat beyond just the building in which the waste heat can be utilized for purposes of energy, and to allow that waste heat to be counted as the as part of utilities conservation improvement programs. So, a little noisy if we could catch the door. Mr. Chair and members, thermal energy is as we all know from all of our utilization of energy, we lose a tremendous amount of our energy. Up to 55% of all of the energy that we generate is lost, and it's lost in the form of thermal energy. We have a number of proven off-the-shelf technologies that we can deploy to capture that, utilize it for our energy needs. Right now, state statute only allows the use of that energy in many instances within the confines of the buildings and the businesses in which it's used. Mr. Chair and members, what this would do is it would allow utilities to participate in deploying technologies through their conservation improvement programs, utilize those resources, work with either energy facilities or businesses to capture that waste heat and count that towards their conservation improvement program for the purpose of offsetting the utilization of gas or electricity, and like I said, count that towards their SIP goals on the demand side of the equation. With that, I have a representative of St. Paul's District Energy who brought this idea to us, and he can speak a little bit more expansively about this idea and why it's such a great bill.
Mr. Smith, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Ken Smith. I'm the president and CEO of Evergreen Energy and District Energy St. Paul. This is something I've been working on for some time. There's a lot of waste heat in our current energy system. Today, approximately 57% of our energy in this state is wasted, and a lot of that is heat. And we can actually capture and repurpose some of that energy and put it back to work in our economy. This bill is while it looks like a small bill, it's the purpose of it is to allow, what really is a limitation in the current statute, to allow the recovery and reuse of waste heat. And if we have waste heat in one facility, we could actually use it in another facility, where currently most of the effort is focused on improving the efficiency of one facility only. We have been working with stakeholders, with the utilities and Mincy and several others to vet this. We think this is a very good bill and encourage you to support it.
What's the amendment?
So, Mr. Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment.
Senator Dilble moves the A1 amendment, and this is the first committee, so it's author's amendment to put the bill in the shape he wants. Is there any discussion?
Not all those. We haven't seen it.
You don't have it yet. I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, I thought it had been up there.
Sorry about that. Mr. Chair, I'll just describe the bill then very quickly. We changed the energy conservation improvement program to include waste heat recovered and used as thermal energy on line 3. We provide a definition a little more narrowly construed in the amendment than is proposed in the bill as introduced to include using thermal energy and to offset, of course, gas and electricity. Then on line 3.21, this is just adding to the definition and the eligible use of waste heat under the Conservation Improvement Program, and we expand that just a little bit to include cogeneration or combined heat and power sources, and we make sure that the department is consulted so that they can approve counting this on the demand side in the SIP goals for a utility. And that's the bill and as drafted with the amendment.
Senator Rose, I'll get to you. Is it on the amendment?
Yes, it is.
Okay, on the amendment. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, of the amendment 1.10, the subject to department approval instead of goals, what exactly are you trying to get at that? Departure.
Mr. Chair and members, that's making sure that that's the Department of Commerce, and it's just making sure that that they're taking a look at natural gas or electric energy is being displaced by use of waste heat recovered and used as thermal energy, and it's being counted towards the SIP goals. The department is just taking a look to make sure that's being done in the proper fashion, proper form or fashion.
Okay.
Senator Dibble, on the A1 amendment, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. On the bill, discussion. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, I actually think this looks like a good bill. My concern is in section 3.
You seem astonished, Senator Brown.
Excuse me?
You seem astonished, Senator Brown. I signed a bill today that your name was on.
Oh, your amendment deleted Section 3. So
yes.
Does this this would open it up for rural Minnesota to qualify then, too. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, this would apply statewide to any utility that's participating in the conservation improvement program.
Okay.
That has a conservation improvement
program. Yeah, I missed that. Thank you, Mr. Fuller.
Senator Dibble, one of the questions I had about it is existing things, and obviously this, Mr. Smith's is one of those. When we talk about renewable energy, hydropower is one that, you know, it's been there and so on. It's been factored in. When we're talking about SIP goals and so on, we're supposed to be making improvements. If all of a sudden you take a big chunk, and I don't know what percentage of it does, this would accomplish. Did you intend for existing ones to be counted towards the goal, or were you thinking of it in terms of new ones, maybe Mr. Smith wants to comment on that, or you?
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, that's part of why the department is involved. I would think it would be new, the way that a utility is able to count effort towards their SIP goals is, you know, by demonstrating that they've participated in some form or fashion, either through using their resources or technical consulting or, you know, they had some role in deploying and implementing new applications, new uses of these technologies to capture waste heat that offsets electricity or gas use. So new, yes. And that's how the SIP program works. In any case, it's the steady reduction in demand over time. So you can't count past effort, anyways, in how the SIP.
I understand that. I was just wondering, right, because the way it's worded, it kind of looked like, oh, we're now going to throw this big pot in there, and St. Paul's is fairly large, and I
right.
just wondered, because if you just say, oh, we're now going to start counting what we haven't counted before. So.
Mr. Chair, the intent is it's new projects, and so it's the new recovery of waste heat that would then displace natural gas, so it's not something that's in place displacing natural gas or electricity use today. It's a project that does that recovers and reuses wasted thermal energy. So it wouldn't be something that is currently in place, whether in St. Paul or any place else in the state.
So, in effect, Mr. Smith, if yours expands, that would count towards the goal, but the existing wouldn't, just all of a sudden, hey, we can count new stuff we've never counted.
Potentially, if we had additional waste heat, yes.
So just to be clear, there's a tremendous amount of waste heat that occurs that comes out of St. Paul District Energy. It's kind of being wasted. I don't think this means that they would have to waste more heat and then go capture that waste heat, the existing heat that's wasted, and you deploy some technology to capture that for the purpose of...
If they expand to more buildings, more,
correct,
et cetera, and district...
Mr. Chair, if I might, this is really not St. Paul-centric. It is really about where we have waste heat in our state, we should be capturing and reusing that. To give you an idea, the U.S. Department of Energy estimates that approximately 1,000 trillion BTUs is wasted in Minnesota every year. And it could be at a factory, it could be at a building, it could be an existing plant, whatever that might be. If we can capture that and put that energy back to work in our economy, considering that we import nearly all of our energy into the state, is a good thing. So this has nothing really to do with District Energy St. Paul. It has everything to do with capturing waste heat where it is, and let's reuse it.
I appreciate that. By the way, how large are you compared to other district energy or cogen things around the country?
We are one of the larger as far as integrated into a district energy system, but there are much larger systems now. The system in St. Paul is still the largest hot water district energy system in North America, but there are now two projects underway, one in Canada and one in Stanford University, that are going to rival us, that will be very close. We're going to have to add some more pipes, so we're larger than them.
Further Mr. Chair. Questions from the committee? Yes.
I don't mean to lengthen the hearing or keep talking when you got the votes, but this is I don't know if this is in your packet or not.
Yes.
That's this one. They're similar, but you know, I mean, fully 55% of the output from our energy sources isn't used in any useful fashion. So if we can even move a few percentage points down into the useful, the utilized energy, we'd be that much better off.
Thank you. Further questions? If not, Senator Dibble moves Senate File 642 as amended. He recommended to pass, and I don't know that it's been requested by any other committees.
No, it has not, so I think it can go to the floor. I'm not averse to also including it in a package if you're putting that together as well. We can dual track if you like.
Keep that in mind.
All right.
Further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senate files.
Is that moved as amended?
As amended.
All right, thank you. All right, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 763 is Senator Dahl back.
We're getting him.
We're getting him.
That's best.
While we're waiting for him because of the time, I wonder if he was in the room earlier and so on. Wonder if we just want to, why don't we start with the testimony, because we have only 50 minutes before we have to break for the afternoon. Mr. Sullivan, do you want to begin? And Senator Dibble,
I was asked to pinch hit if need be, although okay. I'm winging it. So we'll let Mr. Sullivan start off.
Okay, Mr. Sullivan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Sullivan. I'm the regional policy manager for Wind on the Wires. And I think what I would like to do at this time is, since we're do you think we'll have time before we're going to meet till 2:30, right? Okay, so then I think we should be good. I have people from out of town that I want to make sure testify before 6 o'clock if we do have to go over. But again, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. The bill is Senate File 763, and it increases Minnesota's renewable energy standard. Minnesota right now has a blended standard. So Xcel Energy has a 30% by 2020 standard. Xcel is roughly half of Minnesota's retail sales, and then a 25 by 25 standard for everybody else. So the standard is roughly 27.5%. And what the bill does is it increases the renewable energy standard to 40 by 30. So maybe I'll just turn it over at this point to Senator Dahl.
Welcome to the committee. We just barely started. Mr. Sullivan's the only one to testify, but if you want to make a brief introduction now that we've started.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you. And I'm across the hall with some important votes as well. So if I get up and leave, it's not because I don't like you. But thank you, Senator Dibble, for stepping in. I think Mr. Sullivan was saying, we've come a long way, and I was not around when we passed the Next Generation Energy Act in 2007, but when I came in 2008, I was sat on the Energy Committee for 3 years, and I was so impressed with what Minnesota had done in terms of coming together with then-Governor Pawlenty to come up with the 25 by 25 renewable energy standard. I think that the utilities have done a great job in integrating wind energy into the grid and have shown with their own filings that they've been very good for electricity companies. Right now, all the utilities are either meeting or exceeding their renewable energy requirements. And, of course, we think that we can even prove even more. We know that XL, for example, has to reach that 30%, but, you know, when we started the 25 by 25, they were only at 5%, and we know that they're well on their way to meeting that 30% now. So this legislation supports and builds on the strong foundation of skilled wind jobs already in Minnesota, provides long-term affordable electricity rates, brings millions in investments and tax revenues, ensures that Minnesota continues moving toward a more sustainable, less carbon-intensive energy future. So I know it's a very ambitious undertaking, and I'm sure there will be a spirited discussion on both sides of this issue. But, you know, I think as in the classroom, we raise the bar a little bit, and we hope that with a little nudging that we can get our students to meet that bar. And the same goes here with we can do better, I believe, in renewable energy for Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. You want to go start going through the list of witnesses. Mr. Sokolowski.
Thank you.
That's the angle. Okay. Okay. Oh, Chanel Montana as well. I'm sorry.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Adam Sokolsky. I work with Iberdrola Renewables. We're a wind farm developer, owner, and operator. We own about 550 megawatts of wind turbines in Minnesota and about 5,000 over in the United States. I'm going to keep my remarks very short today. As you know, Minnesota has over 125 wind energy projects installed and operating today with over 3,000 megawatts of turbines spinning. Our company and other companies who will come and testify today will have had the experience, very positive experience in Minnesota with landowners, with local communities. Our projects contribute millions of dollars in landowner payments directly. Our company alone employs over 55 people across this state just operating, maintaining, and developing new projects, with the most of those operating and maintaining current turbines. Those are really good salaries, really good wages in rural communities like Jackson, like Trimont, like Lake Benton, and like places like Lake Wilson. They're great jobs. The experience we've had in Minnesota is landowners we work with want to work with us again and again. They want to do the next project, have their land involved in the next project. We've seen that from Trimont all the way up to Lake Benton. It's been a very positive experience. Landowners want us back. It's a win-win situation. These landowners want to harvest an additional crop from their land. They've got the wind. They've got good, fertile soil. They're harvesting the fruits of the soil. And they want to also harvest that wind and provide a safe, clean, inexpensive commodity to the society here in Minnesota. With that, I think I'm going to turn it over to Chanel Montana, who will talk a little bit about her projects and the economic impact of construction projects on local communities. I'll let whoever's up next come up.
Montana, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. To the committee. I am very honored to be here today. My name is Chanel Montana. I am the Legislative and Associate Affairs Director for EDF Renewable Energy, and we are a multinational company with many employees here in the state of Minnesota and a very large regional office in Minneapolis. We have developed over 900 megawatts of wind in Minnesota, and 4,200 megawatts we have developed nationwide. Minnesota has been a fantastic place to do business for us. Our experience has been that these projects operate with extremely high levels of community support. In fact, we would not be able to ever put a project in the ground without the support of the local community. Thousands of project participants and dozens of communities receive sizable yearly payments and additional income. And those communities are not reporting any health problems or safety problems. And these communities really see these wind projects as a way to cultivate another crop on their land. Right now, there are approximately 125 wind projects operating in the state of Minnesota, which equates approximately 3,000 megawatts in all of Minnesota. And almost all of those megawatts are without any controversy at all. You should have received a PowerPoint presentation. It's very brief. It's only four slides. And I just wanted to touch on a couple of things about the construction process for wind. There's a very, very simplistic pie chart that you should see. And essentially all it's saying is that a quarter Only a quarter of all the construction costs go out of the state of Minnesota. Three-fourths of all construction costs for a wind turbine stay within the state of Minnesota. And when we look at our project, the Lakefield project, in Lakefield, Minnesota, we see that that is approximately $30 million that we are putting into local supply chain companies, construction companies, concrete, trucking, and et cetera. When we look at some of the businesses that are affected by the construction of one of our projects, we see businesses from Freeport and St. Cloud, the Twin Cities area, Springfield, Lakefield, and Jackson. We see the economic development and the economic benefits of these projects going statewide. 75 Minnesota businesses were part of the construction of just one of our projects. They were touched by those projects. They were able to grow due to those projects. And again, that's over $30 million just for one project. In addition to that, we've infused about $4 million into the local community, and $400,000 has been sent to construction workers for living and other additional expenses, and that additional money gets infused into those local communities where the projects are built. If I were to leave you with one message today, I would say that developers, supply chain companies, concrete companies, truckers, et cetera, are ready, and we are waiting to move forward with development and further development within the wind industry. There are 3,500 megawatts currently sitting in the MISO queue that are ready to go to construction in some stage. Large and small developers today are looking forward to putting those megawatts in the ground and to really being able to use a resource that Minnesota was given. Landowners in these project areas, I love meeting with them because the first thing we hear is, when do I get my turbine? When are you constructing this project? That's a very significant and special day for them, and we look forward to completing more of those construction projects. EDF alone has paid over $11 million to local Minnesota landowners. That makes a huge impact in counties like Nobles and cities like Lakefield. So again, just to sum things up, we are ready and we are waiting, and we're looking forward to doing additional business in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Montana. Ms. Engel-King and Mr. Paris. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Betsy Engel-King, and I'm Vice President for Geronimo Energy, which is an Edina-based wind and solar developer that develops projects primarily in the upper Midwest. This month marks my 25th year watching energy policy being made in Minnesota. I've also had a part in implementing it, and I find that it's one of the nation's most forward clean energy policies. Every time over the last 25 years that the legislature has gotten together to discuss advancing Minnesota's clean energy project, we've had a very predictable response, and therefore I will predict right now what you will hear from the last five or six speakers on this agenda. They will tell you that it's not possible, that it's too costly, that it's unreliable, that they will need to have backup, that they don't need it. Now, past experience shows us that every time that we've heard those kinds of discussions and the legislature has gone ahead and implemented new clean energy policy, the utilities have been able to implement it faster, better, easier, and cheaper than we even imagined when we first promoted and adopted the policy. Those same arguments heard today ring hollow in the fact that if we know one thing about the electric industry, it always changes. The Renewable Energy Standard is a long-term policy. Right now, we're experiencing a historic set of low short-term prices and excess capacity, much of it brought on by the recent recession. Now, I hate to think that low prices, low natural gas prices, and excess capacity are going to go on forever, because that's going to mean that our economy is not recovered, and that's going to mean a lot of people out of work. But one thing that we know is that these cycles always change. One of the things about building wind energy and building other renewable energy is that, for the most part, it has no fuel cost. It experiences an upfront cost, and then it experiences a very, very low cost of operating and maintaining the facility. Therefore, once you compare that against decisions that are being made today, 30-year decisions to build large plants that operate largely on natural gas,
are going to be at the whim of the natural gas prices of the future. Yes, they're very low now, but in my career, I have seen, this is the third time that I've seen natural gas prices fall to the lowest point that we've seen in a long time, and that people have said they will never go up again. And each of the previous two times, they have gone up sometimes to as much as from $2 at MMBTU to $14 an MMBTU. We can offer wind prices today at an installed levelized cost of between $30 and $40 for a 20-year contract. That price, while it's slightly above the current cost and sometimes the current market price of electricity, will stay the same over the life of those 20 years. As you consider this bill, I hope you consider what you believe natural gas prices will be and what you believe that the trajectory of our electric prices will be in the future. Thanks for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Pete Paris. I'm the political director from the Sheet Metal Workers Local Union. And the statement says I'm a steel worker, I'm a sheet metal worker. Just want to clarify that. I'm here today to urge you to vote in favor of Senate File 763, a bill that would increase the state's renewable energy standard to 40% by 2030. The sheet metal workers are a member of the Blue-Green Alliance, a partnership of labor unions and environmental organizations working to create good jobs and a clean economy. Last week, we stood alongside our friends on the Minnesota Clean Energy Jobs Campaign to express our support for the state legislation that advances the cause of supporting good jobs in the development of clean, renewable energy in this state. Senate File 763 achieves that goal by increasing the state's RES to 40% by 2030. We can support good jobs in our state, manufacturing, installing, operating renewable sources of energy. We can continue to grow a vibrant and forward-looking industry, and we can work together to protect the environment we all cherish for the next generation of Minnesotans. 6 years ago, our state came together in a bipartisan way to advance historic legislation that helped put Minnesota on the map when it comes to renewable energy. The 2007 legislation established Minnesota as a center for renewable energy jobs. As of 2012, the wind industry provided up to 3,000 direct and indirect jobs in our state, according to the American Wind Energy Association. Minnesota's wind-related manufacturing accounted for 400 to 600 jobs, and our state's wind-related supply chain includes more than 100 companies. But we still have a lot more work to do, and that's why it's important that we pass Senate File 763. Minnesota has fallen to seventh in the nation for installed wind farms. By increasing our RES, we can solidify our place in renewable energy industry, we can create good jobs for Minnesotans, and we can continue a transition to clean, renewable energy. Clean, renewable energy creates good family-supporting jobs in a broad range of fields, including truck drivers, crane operators, earth movers, cement workers, and various construction management, consulting, and engineering positions. As a construction worker, these jobs are so important. Our sector by nature means that in order to build a career, we move from one job to the next. Building and investing in things like renewable energy creates good jobs in our sector and many others. And as a Minnesotan, I cherish our lakes, streams, and rivers. I'm an avid hunter, and I know that I want to do what I can to protect the environment for the next generation. These two goals are not mutually exclusive. Union members and environmentalists don't always agree. But on this, we do. We agree that we need to create good family-sustaining jobs through renewable energy. I urge you to pass Senate File 763. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Paris. Next, we have Jerry Gruntner and Byron Christopher. Welcome to the committee.
Chairman. Jerry Gruntner was not able to make it today. My name is Todd Gandred. I'm with M.A. Mortenson Company, Mortenson Construction, and I will be representing our position. Mortenson Construction is a Minneapolis-based, family-owned company with 57 years of construction experience. Currently, we have 2,200 team members, and over 320 of them are in our renewable energy group. Over the years, the wind industry has provided significant opportunities and stability for Mortenson and its employees. Wind currently represents nearly one-third of our company's total revenue. Since 1995, Mortenson has built 125 wind projects. In Minnesota alone, we've constructed 20 wind projects, contributing to over 1,800 megawatts of clean energy. Each of the Minnesota wind projects improves our state's economy while playing a vital role in bolstering the smaller local economies across our state. For example, during construction, jobs are created to employ the local labor force. Major construction contracts are awarded to local businesses and suppliers. Fabrication, maintenance, and repair shops all see increased business. Hundreds of thousands of dollars are spent in local hotels, apartments, restaurants, and community activities due to the construction. Minnesota communities and businesses receive benefits from wind energy, and Minnesota's RES has been critical to helping this. The uncertainty surrounding the PTC has threatened further development of wind industry and thereby our Minnesota economy. Because of the long-term nature of the planning and permitting process, our reliance on PTC extensions is not enough to sustain consistent long-term industry growth. On behalf of Mortenson Construction and others with me today, we ask our legislators to support a long-term solution. A 40% RES by 2030 is not only crucial for the long-term growth of the industry, but also the livelihood of thousands of Minnesotans and local businesses. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you could sign the sheet, because we don't have your name, if you could sign, and that would be helpful. Mr. Christopher.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Byron Christopher. I am from Jackson County, Minnesota, and I have built two wind projects in Jackson County, one of the first ones, in fact. I'm here to give you just a short overview of the prosperity that this has brought into Jackson County, and would like to see this bill go forward and keep the wind industry moving forward like it has in Jackson County. So far in Jackson County, there's approximately 400 megawatts of electricity coming out of there, and it's big income for our people in Jackson County. First of all, the wind and energy is taxed. So you've got this tax money to pass around. And the townships in this county get part of this tax money, and the county gets part of this tax money. Now, in Jackson County, we've got one township that takes in over $200,000 a year. This don't happen one year and then stop. This happens every single year. Now, they used to wonder how they're going to get their money and pay for things. Now they're working just as hard trying to figure out what to do with it so they don't waste it, you know. And the county right now takes in about $1.5 million from this production tax. Well, you know, that's a lot of money because that comes in every single year. That helps lower the taxes, or it helps the county build something that the taxpayer don't have to pay for. And then the third thing is you've got the farmers that are taking in approximately $6,000 to $10,000 per tower. Now, if you figure that out, farmers in Jackson County are taking in about $3 million every single year, and they just don't hoard that money. They spend it. So that money gets passed around. And another thing that you might want to consider is every time there's a dollar made, that dollar's passed around and spent, they claim that that dollar moves around about seven times. In Jackson County, we're taking in about $7 million between the farmers and townships and county and all that stuff. If that's getting passed around seven times, that's a lot of money, you know, that's moving around in that county. And we have got to keep the wind energy going like we have in the past. We've done remarkable things in the last 10 years. And it's up to you people to help keep this wind energy going. As far as renewable resources, we don't have renewable resources like gas, coal, things like that, and oil in this state. But we got the best renewable resource there is, and that's clean air. And it's going to be here forever. Them other things are going to run out eventually, not in our lifetime, but they will run out. This air is going to be blowing all the time. And we've got sunshine. The sun's going to shine all the time, or we're all done. But if we act now, we can keep this wind energy thing progressing and do our state a lot of good. And you're going to hear a lot of bad things about wind, most likely. But I've heard them all. You know, the eagles are getting killed. Well, here's something I swear on the Bible. My son-in-law talked last night. We have been around 20 windmills for 10 years. I have never in my life seen one single dead bird under these towers, and neither has my son-in-law. Now, that's not saying that it hasn't happened and it's not going to happen. But around our 20 towers, it has never happened. And I'll swear that on the Bible. And, you know, it could kill a bald eagle someplace. I don't know. It's possible. But that is very improbable that this is going to happen day in and day out. Birds do get killed. They hit my window in my house. I run into them with my car. The cat kills them. What are you going to do? Kill the cat? Board up your windows and take your car off the road? No. That's going to happen, even with wind, but it's not going to happen that often. And you're going to hear that. And when you can lock in 3-cent wind for 20 years compared to coal, and I've heard it, coal is cheap. But, you know, when people say it's 70% cheaper than wind, coal would have to be a cent 25, and I don't see that. So I don't think you can lock in a cent 25, 1.5 cent coal, but you can lock in 3 cent wind for 20 years. So those are just a few things that I'd like to bring to your attention, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Christopher. We'll quickly have Mr. Easler from Vestas, and we won't finish all the testimony, I don't think, before 2:30. But I will ask, as soon as he's done, if there are any of the people for the later half that might not be able to be here in the evening when we finish it off. So if so, they can go first. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Easler.
Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Easler. I'm the senior plant manager for service for the Vestas wind turbines in Minnesota and Iowa. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on wind energy in Minnesota. I'm a citizen of Bingham Lake, Minnesota, and more important, I represent 75 hardworking, long-term, highly skilled employees who maintain these wind turbines in Minnesota. That's over 700 megawatts of wind power. That's reliable, economical electricity for Minnesotans. And in addition to that, it's providing revenues to rural landowners and, in many cases, turbine owners who are pleased to have wind power in Minnesota. I'd like to share maybe a little bit more about Vestas. Vestas is one of the leading manufacturers of wind turbines in the world, 47,000 wind turbines in 71 different countries. So we're all we do is wind. That is our business, and so we're very committed to this. But from my perspective, I don't expect us to ever replace all of gas and coal-powered electricity. But Windham, that's just my hometown, has a very unique resource. Minnesota has a unique resource we don't have coal reserves. We don't have gas reserves of any real significance in Minnesota. But we have great farmland. We have a beautiful environment. And we have a lot of wind here. I think you guys are all well aware of that. And I think we should take advantage of those wind resources for the long-term good of Minnesota, for long-term jobs for Minnesota, and for reliable electricity for Minnesota. I had more, but I think that's probably all, since you have a busy agenda.
Thank you very much. Mr. Solomon, did you have a wrap-up comment or two? Or
Just really quickly, one more testifier on our side that I didn't include in the list yesterday from the steelworkers.
Very briefly, please, because we're going to already run into the evening for the others. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing us today. My name is Bob Ryan. I work for the United Steelworkers, District 11, out of Minneapolis. Steelworkers are the largest manufacturing union in North America. We represent workers in iron ore mines, paper mills, healthcare facilities, manufacturing, and oil refineries across Minnesota. I'm here today to urge you to vote in favor of Senate File 763. Legislation will increase the state's renewable energy standard by 40% by 2030, and it will support much-needed jobs in the state. To fully understand why the United Steelworkers support the development of wind energy, one must only look as far as its components. A typical wind turbine requires 250 tons of steel, thousands of tons of concrete, about 20 miles of copper wire, and multiple control systems, in all up to 8,000 parts. Increasing the state's RES will not only continue to support good jobs in construction, installation, and operation of wind energy systems in Minnesota, it will increase demand for the components that make wind energy happen. This legislation will support good jobs in Minnesota also. Now, thanks to legislation our state has enacted 6 years ago, we're a leader in wind energy, supporting up to 3,000 direct and indirect jobs, with an estimated 400 to 600 of them manufacturing, including in distributed wind systems, electrical systems, raw materials, power transmission, structural components, and towers. Minnesota's wind-related supply chain includes more than 100 companies, fabricated structural steel, plastics and composite fabrication, turbines and motors, among others. This long-term policy has created a stable environment for the industry to flourish, and we have done well. We are two-thirds of the way to our 25% goal just 6 years into this experiment. However, as we approach that goal, failure to act to raise the bar for renewable energy in our state and to increase demand for wind energy leave the industry looking elsewhere. Increasing the RES will create good jobs and further develop an emerging and thriving industry in Minnesota. It's also going to help transform our economy to clean energy. The United Steelworkers has long held a commitment to environmental protection. USW supported the Clean Air Act, and we support a comprehensive clean energy and climate change legislation because we know that environmental problems don't stop at the plant gates. As a Minnesotan, I care deeply about preserving the environment for the next generation. This bill will help get us there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. For the opposition, are any of you not able to be back this evening? Welcome to the committee. Why don't you go right away? Thank you, Ms. Rosenquist. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Marty. My name is Christy Rosenquist, and I live in rural Goodhue County, Minnesota. I think I have the distinction of probably being the only person testifying today who's not being paid to be here. Senate File 763 is a mandate to increase the renewable energy standard by 40%. Citizens that I have worked with and talked with believe that that is premature. There are several things I believe you're missing at this time. One is an environmental impact study, including a human health impact study. Two is I don't see that there's been a feasibility study done that includes MISO as to whether this is even possible, and I don't see an economic impact study. Third, there is currently a RFP being let by the Department of Commerce asking for an analysis of the results of an upcoming bat and avian fatality study at existing wind farms in Minnesota. And I think those three things would be key for this committee to be able to make good decisions as to whether this is a good plan for Minnesota. In addition, the 2007 Renewable Energy Standard, I've asked the authors of several authors of that, including Ellen Anderson and people who helped design it, like Bill Grant over at the Department of Commerce, what scientific studies were used that would suggest that Minnesota can reduce carbon and close coal plants by using industrial wind as the cornerstone of our energy policy. and they have said there are none, and there were none. And I don't see any here that would suggest that industrial wind as your primary source is going to reduce carbon as you were hoping. Coal plant emissions are down dramatically in Minnesota, and this is not due to the renewable energy standard. You can find this information in the 2012 Minnesota Environment and Energy Report Card published by the EQB last fall. Industrial wind, as I said, causes no reduction in overall CO2 emissions where it's been tried. There are a number of studies out of Denmark, and I've provided that in a packet that I hope the committee has. I won't go through all of that because of time, but Denmark is the only country in the world that has statistically, on paper, achieved a mark of 20% electrical generation from wind. Denmark exports a great deal of their wind energy because it is produced at times when it cannot be used in Denmark. The wind produced an equivalent of 19% of Denmark's energy needs, but it only actually meets about 1.7% of electrical demand. Denmark's experience matches Minnesota's almost exactly. According to the Minnesota Rural Electric Association in 2011, rural rate payers lost $70 million just on the portion of wind that cannot be used by the utility at the time that it is being produced, and it gets dumped onto the MISO market at a loss. I asked MREA what percentage of total wind electricity this represented, and they said this would be between 60 and 70% of the electricity produced by wind. So the majority is being dumped on the MISO market at a loss, just like Denmark. Fresh Energy employee J. Drake Hamilton has been traveling around Minnesota explaining that wind is a benefit to rural economies because in 2011, according to her testimony, between $6 and $7 million in total went to rural landholders, counties, and townships. But with a $70 million rate loss in the same year, this sounds to me like a $64 million loss to rural Minnesota, not a benefit. Several legislators I've spoken with seem to believe that this is perfectly okay, that the majority of the money is going out of state over the life of a project. As long as some millions of dollars land in their district, they seem to be okay with that. I disagree. Minnesota created a renewable energy information exchange with Germany. I recommend you take a look at the situation in Germany. German industrial electric rates have gone up 40% in the past 5 years, and manufacturing businesses are fleeing the country. Germany dumps its wind electricity, which is also produced mostly when they can't use it, onto the grids of neighboring countries, just like Minnesota will do once CapEx 2020 is completed. Germany opened a new 2,200-megawatt coal plant last fall, and they import nuclear energy from France and Czechoslovakia. A key thing I'd like you to learn from the German delegation who visited Minnesota in December is the following. In Germany, they learned that placing large industrial wind turbines close to people's homes caused health problems. Therefore, the minimum setback in Germany between a home and a wind turbine is 3,281 feet. The minimum setback in Minnesota is 500 feet. This is less than one-sixth the minimum distance that Germany considers safe. I think that the legislature needs to address this safety issue. We recommend that Senate File 763 eliminates the requirement for utilities to estimate rate impacts. It does that right at the time when I think it's going to be most needed. I recommend you not do that. We ask that you don't alter the renewable energy credit banking system, and I explain in detail why I think that's a poor idea. I do think you should keep the certificate of need process. I think it's needed by the utilities for planning. I also think you need to evaluate industrial wind's track record before you mandate an expansion of industrial wind, which this bill does. The public records in Minnesota demonstrate on the PUC record, landowner chasing wind developer with brick, wind developer refusing to pay for fence and crop damage, numerous unresolved noise complaints, health complaints, bird and bat kills, loss of habitat, loss of phone service, permanent loss of TV reception, which the Department of Commerce said was impossible, but we have that now. Details about these problems are in your packet. I'd like to highlight three of the projects and the lessons I think that Minnesota should learn from those projects. One is both of them are owned by Xcel Energy, and both of them were built by EDF Renewables. One is the Grand Meadow project. This project, in the first 6 months of operation, had burning underground electric lines and exploding T-junctions. Last fall, Xcel replaced six of the 67 gearboxes at a reported cost of $360,000 each. EDF got the $1 million per turbine from the federal 1603 cash. The other project is Nobles in Nobles County. This operated for 12 weeks before burning electric cables and other problems caused its shutdown. They then had to replace all 134 brand-new pad-mounted transformers. Xcel requested a rate increase, telling the Public Utilities Commission that they learned from the Grand Meadows and the Nobles project that wind turbines produce less electricity and cost more to maintain than they anticipated. Xcel claims they called around to other projects, and they found that this is common, very common, in Minnesota. They produce less, and they cost more to maintain. EDF would have gotten the $134 million in federal cash on that project. I'd also like to draw your attention to the EcoHarmony project, which is being proposed in Fillmore County. Here, the Spanish-owned company Gamesa proposed siting 28 turbines on sinkholes. The turbines are sited in and around bat caves, which ensures maximum bat kill. In addition, the industrial wind standards in Minnesota do not protect human health and the environment. I believe the legislature has an obligation to protect human health, specifically negative human health effects from wind turbines too close to a home. Minnesota does not have an industrial noise standard that measures turbine noise. And yet, faulty noise models using the non-applicable noise standard is the sole factor currently being used to determine the distance between a turbine and my house. Germany requires 1,000 meters. During the past 3 years, I have met, talked with, and read the Public Utility Commission's record of Minnesota's suffering from negative health effects from industrial turbines sited too close. I've gotten to know Vietnam vet Bernie Hagen and his wife Cheryl.
Ms. Rosenquist?
Yes.
Two things. One, I don't want to have you burn up all of the – there are many people who wanted to speak in concerns about the bill. The other thing, and I will ask before you wrap up, is that my staff did not see the email from you with the packet. So we,
okay.
If you can make sure you email it, we'll make sure we get it distributed by this evening.
Okay.
And please wrap up quickly if you
okay,
can.
Okay, I will. In addition, Minnesota's renewable energy laws do not hold wind developers accountable for their behavior. What we're learning in rural Minnesota is that no one represents citizens living in wind projects. There's no local control. Community-based energy development is currently meaningless. It requires zero Minnesota ownership and no longer requires that the majority of revenues flow to Minnesotans. Misinformation on environmental evaluations appears to be routine. A common example would be the Goodhue project. This is an Eagle, one of many, which the developer could not find. They testified to the state of Minnesota that there were zero eagles in Goodhue County and zero nests. And now, according to U.S. Fish and Wildlife, with the help of citizens, we estimate the population at 418 with 9 confirmed eagle nests. So either the wind company was lying in order to get their permit, or perhaps we should contact the Vatican. We've had a miracle. Eagles everywhere. A study on Minnesota's Buffalo Ridge showed a 47% loss of raptors at a wind facility there, which I believe is unsustainable, 47% loss of raptors. Goodhue County is the first project in the nation to ask for an incidental take permit to kill between 8 and 14 bald eagles without being prosecuted under federal laws. In conclusion, I don't believe that our 2007 renewable energy mandate can produce the results you want, except perhaps on paper. And I don't see how increasing that mandate is going to change that. I would ask you to address the significant problems that are currently existing in the wind industry in Minnesota and provide some protection to citizens and to the environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rosenquist. And we make sure you, our staff gets that. We will distribute the thing to the committee tonight. Mr. Padden. From Great River Energy.
So, Mr. Chair, do we have time for a quick question?
Sure, go ahead.
Say, Ms. Rosenquist, I understand you're not going to be able to join us tonight, and I just wanted to compliment you for your continued interest in this issue and also your thoughtful contribution to the dialogue. I understand your concerns with the 2007 RES and with Senate File 763. Could you just briefly share with us your alternatives? I mean, we have stated goals of diversifying our energy portfolio here in Minnesota. It's easy to be against something, but if we're moving towards sustainable renewable energy, if not wind, then what?
Mr. Chair.
And briefly, please.
Yes. I think there's three things that Minnesota could do that would have a significant impact. One would be to update your nuclear plants using current technology that reuses spent fuel. I asked Bill Grant if this would reduce the stored nuclear fuel at our facilities, and he said yes by two-thirds. I think that we could spend our money more wisely on research and development of thorium reactors. It's more abundant and safer than uranium. I think that we have plenty of universities that could be spending their time and money doing that rather than looking at wind turbines. And I think, thirdly, that you should count high-head hydro in your renewable energy standard. I realize that Hi-Head Hydro does have some environmental drawbacks, but I do not think that those environmental drawbacks from Hi-Head Hydro are as significant as they are for wind energy. And Hi-Head Hydro actually produces reliable electricity, something which wind cannot. Thank you.
Mr. Padden, for the other witnesses, we hope you'll be able to, I think most of you look like people will be around this evening as well. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Greg Padden, and I'm the manager of member resources and pricing at Great River Energy, a not-for-profit electric cooperative that provides wholesale electricity to 28 distribution members across Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to share our concerns with you, and I will be brief. We'd like to explain why we oppose this bill as currently proposed. We understand and sympathize with the difficulty and complexity of trying to create a sustainable long-term energy policy. And with this in mind, we ask you to be mindful of both the intended and unintended consequences of your decisions. I have just three points. Number one, increasing the renewable energy standard from the current mandate of 25% by 2025 will put Minnesota at a competitive disadvantage. Great River Energy has 470 megawatts of wind that we've put together in a portfolio of resources, geographically dispersed, added at different prices at different times, and together that portfolio has an average price of about $40 per megawatt hour, very similar to the number you heard earlier today. Yet what you didn't hear is what the MISO wholesale market values that energy at. And in 2012, it was just $14 a megawatt hour. The result was for our members, we're left to shoulder the burden of $38 million in 1 year in rate impact because of that differential. And we're only halfway to the goal. We are meeting the 25% goal right now, but we're just halfway there. Another concern with this bill is the rate of increase of future mandates. In other words, right now we're on a pace for about a 1% a year increase. Yet, once we get to 2025, that triples to 3% a year in order to get to 40% by 2030. Second, a new solar energy standard that's been proposed in here, and clearly there's no percentages right now, really represents the most expensive and least efficient way to meet any environmental goal of reducing emissions or reducing carbon intensity. If you were to look at a 10% solar mandate, which is a number that has been proposed, for GRE, it would require us to install 825 megawatts of solar energy. And that has a price tag of $3.6 billion. And if you were to amortize that over the life of those projects, that would be roughly $425 million a year, or a 36% rate impact to our members. Now, clearly that wouldn't happen in 1 year, but you can do the simple math. A 1% solar mandate still is a $366 million capital investment that has $42 million of annual costs over a 20-year life for our members. Committee members, I've talked with some of our distribution cooperatives who are not filling positions right now in order to make up a $25,000 annual budget shortfall. $42 million would just be devastating for them. Finally, and something that hopefully we can all agree on, is that long-term banking of renewable energy credits really is a best practice, and it's something that makes renewable energy more affordable. RECs represent the positive environmental attributes of renewable energy, and under the current renewable energy standard, they have a shelf life, if you will, of the current year plus four additional years. This proposed bill would cut that by 75% down to just 1 year, and the end result is we would lose a very valuable tool for managing how how we add renewable resources to our portfolio and how we mitigate both the operational and financial impacts to our members. So in closing, as you consider this bill and the many other bills that you will be hearing this session, I'd ask you to make one universal amendment, at least in your mind. Every time you see or hear the words electric utility, please think electric ratepayer. The cost of the policy decisions that are being discussed here will be borne not by utilities and faceless stockholders. They will be borne by Minnesota ratepayers. Churches, schools, small businesses, low-income households all will have to live with the consequences of these decisions. Thank you again for the opportunity to be here with you, and I look forward to continuing to work on a sustainable energy policy for all of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Patton. Senator Benson, you had a question?
For Mr. Paddock, and just getting up to speed with solar, with wind, when we talk about capacity, the difference between capacity and generation is about 30% of the total capacity is actually useful for generation. At least that was a number that I was familiar with. In solar, is there a similar ratio? So if you put in an 825-megawatt facility, how much of that is going to be useful for actually getting to customers?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Benson, let me try answering it this way. We looked at to meet a 10% solar energy, so enough solar energy to supply 10% of our retail sales, our members' retail sales, that would require 825 megawatts of solar capacity, which has an average capacity factor, or production, if you will, of about 15%. That's on average what it produces. Again, very site-specific to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have plenty of others, but unless any of the other witnesses are going to be very brief, I will suggest we hold off until this evening, and we are reconvening at 6 o'clock in room 112 across the hall. Thank you very much, Mr. Patton. And with that, this committee will be in recess.